right, that's an amazing track from Martial Art, spinning out to you, Long Distance Dedication. That's a good song from Martial Art. I'm really glad that is our theme song. Welcome, everyone, to Escapist... God, what are we calling this again?
Escapist Podcast, Volume 2.
Volume 2. It's Escapist Volume 2, but this is Volume 2 of the podcast. See, yes. We're editors, we get to move words around. That's our jobs. I'm Russ Pitts, editor-in-chief. It's our prerogative. I'm Russ Pitts, editor-in-chief of Escapist Magazine, Volume 2. Like and subscribe. It's actually really good to be back doing this. I had so much fun doing the original podcast that I wasn't on. This one, though, I'm on. And I'm doing it. And I've got Anthony with me. Anthony, managing editor. Hello.
Hi, everybody. What is even happening? You guys are living with us in the hellscape world of Peter Molyneux's Milo. Everything that I just said are real words that are real references to things. And I recommend that you go Google them.
Yeah, I don't know how Aurora is going to end up. Our producer Aurora is going to end up cutting all this together. But we've been trying to make this podcast happen. Not only... like figuratively for months, literally been trying to make this podcast happen for hours today. Many of those hours are on tape and we can play them for you. At one point, it's like we're all high or something. It's like, oh my God, I'm waiting for this podcast to go.
We apologize for like any slap happiness of this first episode, but we've just been sitting here spinning our wheels, trying to get Google Hangouts and Skype and Audacity to function. And yeah.
Oh, ASMR content.
Ah, man, what if Milo, what if Molyneux's Milo is actually Milo?
I hope this is the content that you guys have all come here to listen to.
We're through the looking glass.
Sam Nelson, senior editor, Escapist Magazine Volume 2. Say hello, Sam.
Hello.
And we have Riley Constantine, scribe. For Escapist Magazine Volume 2. That is the best title. I actually want that title for myself.
Hello there. The official title is Escapist Scribe.
How does it get any better than that?
What's a scribe?
Look it up. Google it.
It's a medieval term,
yeah.
Riley.
Yeah.
So,
it implies that one day you will wrench the sword from the stone.
That's right. As quasi-religious connotations, but I think it's more about sort of the one in the position to write everything down and have the receipts. So make sure you keep track of where all the bodies are buried, because someday this is all going to come out, and you'll be the one subpoenaed. Sorry, I was watching the news before we got on, and I'm just so excited. About dawn breaking raids on Roger Stone's house. FBI agents literally volunteering to work unpaid to arrest. We're not going to get too much into politics, but
nothing new there. Nothing new there.
Yeah, but that's a beautiful timestamp.
Yeah,
it's
beautiful,
exciting.
Beautiful cap on this is exactly the moment in time that we're recording it. I feel like that feeds into our extra strength punchiness too.
Oh, yeah.
That like we're recording this mid-apocalypse.
The Division 2 is launching soon, and this is actually really an impressive marketing stunt that they've had the whole world spiraling into doomsday just so that, you know, by the time the release is out, we'll be there. We'll all be on the same page.
We're all there. Yeah, tell us, Simon, you're actually on your way out to San Francisco to play some Division 2. Tell us about that. And I guess LaGuardia just got shut down, first of possibly many.
Supposedly, I mean, it's we're recording here on Friday now. On Monday, supposedly, I'm going to be flying from Chicago through LAX into San Francisco to play and interview some people about the Division 2. We'll see if that happens. I'm certainly hoping it will. I'm excited to check out the game, which is apparently now a full RPG with all your classic upgradable systems and stories and fun, exciting stuff. And I want to be able to share as much as I can about what it's like to play it and what people who are making it have in mind for you. But that all really depends on whether TSA people show up. So,
well, it's an ARG now, actually. So you actually have to find your way to San Francisco with a shutdown transportation system.
Cool.
Maybe we can Amtrak you out there. Yeah. And your reward for doing, though, is a scarf.
A scarf.
It's a scarf.
All right,
you get
sweet.
A jaunty scarf.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful scarf.
Sounds good. I'm pumped.
Russ, why are we doing a podcast for Escapist Magazine?
Because, well, I mean, it's fun and the people need their content, right? We are content machines. But I think most of all, there's, you know, people want to know who we are and what we're doing and why I think the real question is, why are we doing Escapist Magazine Volume 2?
Yes.
Fair question.
That's really it.
That's it. So why? And I got this question a lot because I was, you know, when I was trying to reacquire the thing ages ago, it feels like a lifetime ago. That was the, you know, that was the question people would ask me. I would say, hey, I've got this great idea of buying the Escapist and relaunching it. And you know, very serious billionaire people would say, and I'd give my pitch and I had my deck and everything. It's like, these are the people I'm going to work with. And, you know, this is my strategy. And they're like, okay, this all looks very good. Do you have any, great. So you're going to, you know, give me some money so I can buy this thing. I'm like, I mean, do you have any questions? Like, why?
Smoke bomb.
Yeah,
like, you vanish.
A short answer for me is it needed to happen. Escapist magazine was in a bad place. And I'm not going to say too much about that for reasons, but I was not comfortable with the last chapter of Escapist magazine being its final chapter. I mean, I feel like there was more that we had to do with it. You know, there was more I wanted to do with it when I left in 2011. But, you know, life goes on. I was kind of content to sort of look at this as a previous chapter in my life and let Escapists go on and let the new folks taking over at various times do their thing and make it great. And it did, the fortunes just turned. And so it was on the verge of being literally erased. The owners were just going to delete it. Members of the community reached out and said, hey, this is happening. And I could not let that happen. The Escapist has meant too much to me over the years. It's where I started my career in games. It's where I met my wife. You know, we won awards. We did lots of cool stuff. We worked with some great creators, some of whom are back with us. And so, you know, I just had to give it a shot. And I don't know if anybody else would have. So that's that. Why are we doing a podcast? Because we want you to know more about why we are doing this.
Yeah.
Why we started this, what our plans are, what our goals are. And some of that comes out through the content. Some of it, you just really have to get in a room with us and sort of live in our heads for a minute.
Okay.
Which is going to be a really great experience today.
I always think to myself, we say jokingly, like, we've got to feed the content beast.
Feed it.
And, you know, if you go to the DMV in 2019, they're like, all right, are you going to do your eye exam? And how many podcasts do you currently record on a given week? Like, all of those things are, yes, podcasts are very common and it is an outlet needs one, but that's not really why we're doing this. Your response of this is fun and you need to know who we are is like the most essential aspect of this, I think.
We get dinged a lot. I mean, you know, everybody has a writing voice, and I think a lot of people, their writing voice is very similar to their personalities. And I think all of us in our careers and in the work we're trying to do at Escapist, you know, we're trying to reach a little bit higher with our work and our output and for the magazine. And we want to talk about things that not a lot of people are talking about. And you have to write about those things in a way that you know, you know, I'm going to write about those things in a way that I'm not necessarily going to talk about them with somebody in a room, right? Because I want to get it on paper. I want to get it on paper for posterity. I want, you know, lots of people to read it and understand it. But if I'm talking with you in a room, I can use lots of likes and use no punctuation and talk like Bob does, you know, and just like thousands of run-on sentences in one. And they all make sense because because I'm like talking to you and I'm looking at you and I'm punctuating with my hands. You can't write like that. So, you know, I think it's super great if folks take the time to listen to the podcast. They can come in here, they can get to know us. Maybe that helps bridge the gap a little bit between, you know, I mean, I think the website's going to stand on its own. It's going to be great, but there's all this history for the Escapist, and we all ourselves have personal history, and it just gets weird. And this is a time in the age of the internet where people actually care and have time to engage with content creators and get to know them as people and consume things like podcasts. And that wasn't always the case. You know, it's important for us to ride that train and to sort of get out in front of people and put ourselves as editors, which can be weird sometimes because you just want to hide in a cubicle and do your thing. I do. I mean, that's where I'm most happy, but like, you got to get out and get to know people and let them know you. And then, you know, they have more of an affinity for the content that you're producing.
It's funny. I like to hide in my cubicle because that's where I work on the charts and the flows of how everything is connected.
It's also known as a crazy board. Anthony's actually like a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah. Like our editorial process of the magazine is I work on the crazy board and then like I burst in Kramer style into Sam's office. And I'm like, Sam, I figured it out. Look.
It all relates to Don Quixote. Read my lead all about how Don Quixote and Resident Evil 2 are connected. I'm like, oh boy, Anthony, tone it down.
Done.
There we go. Right. Let's do it.
Riley, put it in CMS.
Yes. Right away. This is being written in blood.
Yeah, pretty much. Get us find photos to make this look good.
So yeah, that is the tube in which we are packing the sausage in a rich, fun way.
Okay. Is that what we're gonna go with? Okay.
That's the metaphor we got.
I mean, aren't people not supposed to want to see that because it's gross?
No, getting to know how the sausage is made is what it's all about.
I'm really not sure. Okay. I mean, that's fine. That's fine. We'll go with it.
We're going to move on for the metaphor.
If y'all agree, I mean, yeah, we decided earlier that the way the podcast was going to work is that I would theoretically be hosting, and that I would just sort of float in and like say things. And then Anthony would keep us on time and make sure everything happened. And then, and then it's like, it's almost like that's how this actually works.
It's almost, we've created a microcosm for the magazine itself.
Oh yeah, this podcast is just a like representation of the entirety of The Escapist.
There you go.
Look, yeah. I'm not a details guy. I mean, let's just...
Yeah, just on the big picture, Anthony's got like the flow chart of how much time we each have to talk about our deals. And I'm trying desperately to keep you guys from rambling too much.
Yeah, that's it. That's where it is.
Boom. That's
and then
it.
I'm just here to add a good opportune comment.
Yeah, your flavor commentary. I mean, it's basically the magazine in podcast form, except the behind the scenes. Not let's erase the sausage reference. It's behind the scenes.
Yeah, that was kind of weird.
Aurora, you keep that sausage reference. There it is. We'll go with like a Morningstar Farms vegan option though.
Gross.
I'm all with this sound effect app. I'm just loving this sound effect app. Everybody, like and subscribe to this, by the way.
Ross, as everybody smashes that like button, what have you been doing with yourself in terms of what you're actually consuming? What are you playing? What are you reading? What are you watching? What are you living?
Wow. You know, I just started Punisher Season 2. On the Netflix.
How are you liking that?
I'm liking it a lot. You know, I actually took a break on Punisher. I watched the first season. I watched the first three episodes, and I wasn't happy with where it was going. It seemed like it hit a trough, and I let it lie fallow until I was on a shoot in Toronto in October. And the internet was terrible, and I couldn't really get anything, but I could get Netflix. So I was like, I'll try Punisher again, and it really picked up.
Yeah.
The tail end of season one of Punisher was actually really great. My criticism of season one of Punisher was that you got like 10 minutes in episode one of the Punisher being Punisher, and then the rest of it was this weird like soap opera, and like, why do I care about feelings?
That is every Netflix MCU show. Like, they have to feel like, and I think the Punisher honestly was like the least guilty about that. Like, at least we weren't like, I don't know, the poor Donna, is it?
No, you thought she was Donna from The West
Wing.
Right,
I know. I make that mistake all the time.
Karen Page is 21st century West Wing
exactly.
Donna.
Exactly. She's like, Donna.
Hey, can we have a nice blonde who occasionally finds her confidence?
Yeah.
But she's just there for everybody to explain things to.
Yeah, she has a thing for Frank, but she'll never admit it.
Yeah, she's really just there for like white men to like emote to. And it's just so sad. Like, they just don't know. No one has ever known what to do with her, and like it's
Donna,
it's such a problem.
She's basically the super her superpower is basically to have a shoulder to cry on.
Yeah, and aww. I found the plot in Daredevil where she's like, I guess I'm gonna be a journalist now. I found that like personally insulting.
The most angering thing about her just deciding to become a journalist is she fucking walks into this newspaper and they give her an office.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, you don't have a single
byline.
I've never
had an office.
Here's a gorgeous Midtown Manhattan office. Just move on in.
Yep.
She gets an office and a byline.
Yeah.
And becomes the star reporter. She's a fucking paralegal. And now she's the star reporter.
No,
okay,
and that's the thing, great. Is like when Daredevil season 2 ends with this, like, with this dramatic reading of her piece, it's like, it's so bad. The piece is so bad. And just like, I really wanted the editor to be like, wow, I really just didn't know what I was thinking. I wanted you to report on the Punisher story, and here's this thing about how we are all the Punisher, and I'm just like, no. Mm-mm.
No, we're not all murderers.
It's not even on character. Yeah. So he was definitely a weak part of season 1, but it got better. Towards the end, it got better, and I enjoyed it. So season 2, I decided to give it a shot. I'm probably 5-6 episodes in. Mm-hmm. First 3 episodes of season 2 are phenomenal. Like, they must have taken notes, because it's a wonderful intro to the character, to the story. You know, it does that video game thing where halfway through the game, he's lost all his powers and his tools, right? He's not wearing they're going to try to work him up to wearing the actual Punisher t-shirt every time. Yeah, that's going to get old. But it's really good, and it's a much better story. And Karen, Donna hasn't shown up yet.
Yeah, so she's not in that season at all. Although, I honestly was not as impressed with season 2, but I finished it. So your mileage may vary. So, but I found they basically have like 2 big plots going on in that season, and they just don't intersect in any meaningful way.
Spoiler.
Sorry.
Well, that's kind of the problem with the Marvel shows to begin with.
Yeah, you think they will. There's the expectation they will, because they have every reason to.
Yeah, and they just really never do.
And maybe they're hoping that'll happen in season 3, but guess what? Oh, Disney! Oh,
yeah, I mean, it hasn't been officially canceled, but it's definitely canceled.
I don't think they can. I think they have to bring it back. He's such the Punisher. John Bernthal, he's like Punisher I've ever seen.
He nails that role.
He is the Punisher. And it's like, it's just his war cry in the battle scenes. I'm like, holy cow. Yeah. That is literally what a rage machine sounds like when he's charging at you to rip your throat out, right? Yeah. Not that I know, but like in my imagination.
Your mind's eye, it's perfect. Yeah. I like the entire episode of Daredevil season 2 where it's just the two of them talking on a roof.
Yeah.
And debating the relative merits of vigilantism. Mm-hmm. That is to me the platonic ideal of the Netflix Marvel shows. It's like that one, the Jessica Jones episode where she's like trapped in her old childhood home. Mm-hmm. Like the more that these characters are just like sitting there talking to one another and ruminating on what they actually are in the lead up to the cathartic action is when that stuff freaking sinks.
Yeah. Have you guys watched Daredevil season 3?
Loved it.
No,
I did not.
Okay.
Oh, really, Riley?
Yeah, really.
It's excellent. You know, I was not wild about, like, I loved the Punisher stuff in Daredevil season 2, but wasn't wild overall about it. Whereas I thought Daredevil season 3 was like a wonderful return to form. But there's this, like, you know, this isn't too much of a spoiler for Daredevil's like ruminating over whether he needs to kill Kingpin, because it's like the system can't hold him. What do I do? And I just really wished he had like a talk with Punisher.
That would make sense.
Right?
It's like you have this character in universe, like even like a theoretical, like this is just inside my mind and the Punisher is like the bad devil on my shoulder saying, no, kill him. Like I just, it's one of those things where it seemed like such a missed opportunity.
Just do it in text messages. Boop. Hey, bro, what's up?
Yeah.
Boop. Nothing, man. How's the blindness going? How are you typing? Anyway, boop. Don't ask. Boop. Hey, listen, I'm thinking about killing Kingpin. You have any thoughts on that? Boop. Do it.
Yeah, okay, totally do it. It's like text for superheroes.
No, seriously. You'll feel great. He'll feel great. Just go for it, man.
I would have done it. I would have done it already, but I was just waiting for you to do it.
Yeah, it's like I just didn't want to encroach on other people's supervillain territory. Like, that just seemed really rude. It's like against the code.
I have a bet with Spider-Man.
Hey, is Donna there begging you not to kill him?
Yeah.
Could you ask Donna? I don't know. She's busy mooning over you and leaving her laundry on the floor of art gallery. So hang on. It's like, whoop.
I just want a show that's about the guy who plays Foggy working in his parents' butcher shop. That's the show I want.
The alternate life of Foggy besides being like a high-powered attorney.
Yeah, and it's just him like walking in every day muttering the theme song to Night Court to himself. Slicing pieces of turkey. Freaking rule.
Before Anthony, before you crack the whip and move along, I do also want to talk about Fallout 76.
Oh, you do?
I do.
The cursed Fallout 76.
Well, I've been spending a lot of time on it, see. And I want to talk about it. Cuz I feel like this is the venue. I feel like this is the right place and time to talk about it, because it's less of a, cuz you know, this is what we do in the podcast. You're like, "Hey, what you been doing? What you been playing?" Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it is what I've been doing and what I've been playing. But I think this is less about that and more of a call for help, I
think. For us, you're asking for an intervention where we say, Russ, stop playing Fallout 76. It's a bad game.
It doesn't love you like you love it.
It's a good game. It doesn't mean it. It loves me.
It said it won't hurt me again. This was my fault.
I think this time, I think I logged in incorrectly. Or I think when I took too long to post a screenshot to PS4 share, and then it didn't mean to boot me.
Oh,
it booted
boy.
Me because it's my fault. And I need reassurance that, you know, the love I'm giving this game is going to be returned someday. Is that, am I asking too much?
Yes.
Who here is waiting for the episode of this podcast in like 6 months where Russ is doing a karaoke version of I Will Survive sung directly to Bethesda? I have to admit, I was petrified of your shitty bonus collector edition pack-ins.
Oh my God. Anthem is his rebound boyfriend.
Look, I've put in 300 hours, at least 300 hours in every Fallout game, including the originals, right? I love Fallout. I love Bethesda's Fallout, even though it's distinctly not Fallout. I wrote about this. Check it out. Link. But this game is two things. It is, one, more Fallout, which is awesome. I'm loving Fallout. Number two, it's not more Fallout. And I'm trying to resolve those two things in my head. I think the thing that kills me is that it's multiplayer, obviously. So you're playing Fallout, you got this experience of like being alone in a wasteland and exploring things. And a lot of those Bethesda games really require you put a lot of your own imagination into the experience. And that's kind of why I love them. It can be whatever you imagine it to be. And then you see someone else and you realize everything you imagined yourself to be doing in this world is wrong. You're just a sometimes badly rendered character floating through the landscape, standing still at chests while a menu pops up in front of you, getting killed and thrown around in weird ragdoll ways. And it's like, that it's just a weird experience of being detached from myself and what I imagined myself doing in this world. And suddenly, no, you're being faced with the reality that you're a weirdly rendered character in an occasionally buggy game engine, you know, and there's hundreds of you. Oh, and occasionally someone's going to drop a nuke. And it's like,
that sounds miserable. That sounds like the antithesis of what a video game is supposed to be, wherein like it's not an enriching personal narrative. It's not an enriching pre-tailored narrative. It's not a world where you can discover your own experience uninterrupted, and it's not a proper multiplayer.
It's not even an enjoyable power fantasy.
Yeah.
No. But underneath is all the is you know, Fallout 4 is great, and it's basically more Fallout 4, new content. And it's just weird. I'm really torn on it because I love it. I'm enjoying it. I also hate it, and I'm hating it. You know, and it's like, but depending on the day, one feeling dominates, and I can't stop myself from keep going back to it. This is why I'm volunteering for all these reviews, guys. I'm like, I need to get out of the house.
Yeah, you need something to pull you out of this hole.
Yeah,
exactly. Metro is going to save you. I think yeah. Metro. Like, in Soviet Russia, Fallout plays you, Metro, is going to rescue you from this pit of despair that you've fallen into. It's weird to sit there and think that you're so in love with an aesthetic that is very particular to an intellectual property. Like, it's not just the general apocalypse aesthetic. You love the Fallout aesthetic.
I mean, I get it. It's true of, like, so many fandoms. Like, it's, you know, it's why people read mediocre fan fiction or, you know, watched the Star Wars prequels or, you know, continue to read the, like, Dune series written by Frank Herbert's misbegotten offspring. It's, you know, there's just sometimes people desperately want more of a world and are willing to accept whatever trash comes with it if it's got something in there that resonates with them.
Sam, all I heard was Frank Herbert and misbegotten. I just stopped there.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
That's just where I went.
You took me instantly back to like 1998-99, sitting in front of my low bandwidth internet watching that first Phantom Menace trailer thinking, more Star Wars.
Exactly.
Finally, this is going to be amazing. And it wasn't. It really wasn't. It was just so not.
There's so, like, I actually just went back the other day and rewatched the Phantom Menace trailer, the initial one that I went to go see The Water Boy in the theater to see.
Oh, boy.
And the very first shot is so captivating because it's just like this foggy forest. And you're like, oh, shit, what's in there? And then really horrible pastel duck men start coming out of the forest. And you're like, it's gonna be fine! It's gonna be fine!
You know what? I really didn't want to know. The mystery was far better.
Yep.
It's like the Jaws and the shark.
Yep.
Oh. It's better when the duck things were just behind the fog.
Yeah, but Riley, nobody is going to put an oxygen tank into Jar Jar's mouth and say, smile, you son of a bitch, and then blow it up for my pleasure.
Oh, but I wish they had.
Yeah, right?
Well, I mean, they do come from underwater, so it would work that way, too.
That's a good point. That's true. A good point.
Yeah.
Sam, I want to bring it on back to Netflix with you. We're going to return to the land of Donna and her domain with all the Marvel superheroes that you've been...
Sorry.
I've made that mistake so many times and it's so embarrassing, but like somehow telling.
Yeah, very telling. What did you recently watch on Netflix that is distinctly high quality and not really a show?
So Bandersnatch. On Monday night, I decided to finally dig into this. It came out in the holidays, but I was traveling and busy and hadn't had a chance to see what all the excitement was about. And it was delightful.
All right. So if anybody is listening to this, I feel like we can like say like the Punisher show, and there's enough background and context that people are gonna be like, oh yeah, I'm vaguely familiar with the Punisher. I feel like Bandersnatch is still a little bit of an unknown quantity. So I know that it is associated with Black Mirror, even though it's not like a proper episode of Black Mirror. So like, what is it?
Okay, so it's a weird beast. So it is very much within the universe of Black Mirror in that it makes references repeatedly to other episodes of Black Mirror and like some of the technology that exists in Black Mirror. But it is and it's also very much of the themes of Black Mirror. But effectively, what it is a choose your own adventure TV show. So it's kind of like a hybrid between like a TV show and a narrative video game in which you'll watch parts of the TV show and then there'll be like quick time events where you have to make a choice. And that choice will determine what gets played for you next. And so that starts off like really basic as almost like a test, you know, here's how this is going to work. Like, what cereal do you want to eat in the morning? And then they play the clip of like the cereal being poured. But then it gets like increasingly complicated and like the bridges that these follow are not at all intuitive. And so, there's been... You know, we spent about maybe 3 hours playing through various versions of this game and watching things kind of morph and change and trying to like go back and find new versions and new paths and then just being surprised by like ways that our decisions had very subtly changed for various scenes. But the base concept is it's 1984 and you're a controlling a video game designer who's making a video game, an adventure video game based on Bandersnatch, which is this book, a choose your own adventure book that was written by this guy that then went totally insane while he was writing the book and killed his wife.
Sounds like a Black Mirror plot.
Oh,
I know that choose your own adventure has decided to sue the producers of Black Mirror.
Oh, really? That's amazing.
Yeah, they're like, hey, stop taking our shtick where, like, you might find the Loch Ness Monster and you might not.
Yeah, I don't think that that's, like, a really patentable thing at this point.
Is Bandersnatch a real... It's not a real choose-your-own-adventure
book?
No, it
is not.
It's totally fictional?
All right.
No, it's a word from Jabberwock.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, it's the bad guy from old Lewis Carroll.
Yeah. Now, the bad guy from All of His Carol is Opium, I think.
Well, there are a lot of
real bad guys.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are some very kind of weird Lewis Carroll references in here that I won't get into to avoid spoiling things. But it's delightful. It's weird. So my favorite part of this is that there are many different endings. And a lot of the endings are based around how your game turns out. And there's this just... amazing like replication of like an 80s TV show segment where there's this like I don't know shaggy-haired, glasses-wearing, pasty dude who's talking about how much he likes the game. And based on how you've done in portions of the game, he'll give it some number of stars. And so, like, they're one of the main goals is, like, I mean, I guess theoretically main goals is how do you get your game to be 5 stars in his eyes? And it's so delightfully weird.
That's bizarre. So you said, when you were talking about, like, just the way it flows, that as you were, like, pushing the edges of what different options and different paths you could open, that you would see the same scenes that were very subtly different?
Yeah.
How subtly different? Like, is it a totally different shot? Did they do, is it, like, a different take?
So, like, for one instance, there's a scene where, like, the video game programmer calls, is on the phone with his boss. In some versions of it, the boss says, you know, he needs help and sends this other guy to go, like, check on him. And in another version, he gets upset at the video game programmer and, like, decides to go himself to this guy's house. And, like, that sets up, like, these very different, like, pivoting paths for how the interaction goes. But, like, it's fundamentally the same scene. It's, like, two guys sitting in an office answering a phone call, and then, like, the dialogue is different.
Mm. Does any of this feel, like, it sounds super interesting. And it does make me, like, want to go get Sega CD games
right out.
Like, I'm going to play Sewer Shark now. Awesome. But at the exact same time, it doesn't necessarily sound like it would be replicable. Like, it seems like the gimmick of Bandersnatch is so tied in with the premise of the story that they're trying to tell that it might not be something that they can do multiple times.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the question, is like, this one is a very meta version of it. Like, you know, it's about, at some point, the character begins to question whether he has free will or whether his actions are being controlled by someone, which is pretty great. But
classic
Black
Mirror.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this works really well for Black Mirror and for this meta version. But I could honestly see things like that. It requires, I mean, this was apparently like a huge undertaking that delayed the filming and the release of the new season of Black Mirror, just because it took them so much time to build this thing. But you know, I mean, this is not dissimilar to a way, you know, a lot of modern video games do narrative paths.
Sure.
And so I think there's some possibility of in amazingly Black Mirror creepiness factors, Netflix is apparently recording every decision that you make and using it to analyze you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep. Oh, God.
Yep, of course they are.
Come on, yeah. Netflix. You know...
So it took them longer than they expected, and it pushed release of a follow-on thing. It sounds exactly like video game development.
Yeah, exactly. It's fundamentally a TV show video game hybrid, and I could see something like that becoming more popular as people are watching more of their shows through streaming and through devices that are capable of that kind of input. Just like, you know, it doesn't have to be this weird meta narrative where like a guy maybe knows that you're controlling him, but just like, I would like to focus more on this version of the story or follow this character. They're my favorite character. I want to see more of them.
But it reminds me of some of the very early sort of narrative based video games too, right? Where you kind of had to have that meta conceit to sort of ease people into the idea, right? Like a lot of the early Sierra games too had those sort of fourth wall breaking callbacks, you know, like, I imagine that I'm a person sitting at a desk in the early 20th century. What would I make of this? Right?
Yeah.
Yuck.
It's like, totally sophomoric, but like freaking Leisure Suit Larry. Leisure Suit Larry opens with calling you, the player, a pervert. Like, you are a pervert, you're playing this game, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, and so I think that this, it could be effectively doing the same exact thing of trying to ease people into this concept, and that this is almost a proof of concept of how well it works and how enjoyable it is. And for, you know, Netflix, I know, is one of their main goals is to build buzz. It's not, you know, their streaming service lives off of people talking about their products on Twitter, on Reddit. And the fact that people are not really clear what decisions lead to what outcomes, and so there's so much discussion about how to do this. It's like, it's very much like a video game guide. It's like walkthroughs, like, here's what I did and here's what the outcome of got, and here's how, you know, the ending I got from this, and how do you get the better ending, and what is like the secret information that's hidden there that you'll need to input at this one particular time. And so I I think that it's going to have to be big studios that are doing it, like your Netflix and your Amazon and, you know, maybe eventually Hulu. But I would not be surprised if this takes off in some fashion.
This reeks of like a Deadpool opportunity.
Oh, it does. Yeah, exactly. Any of your like weirder meta things are just built for it.
Riley, Russ, are you Black Mirror fans in general? Do you guys watch a lot of Black Mirror? Are you into it?
I've seen an episode.
Okay.
I've seen an episode. No committal to quality. It is a show that you are aware of.
It's a show I'm aware of. I've seen an episode.
My wife watches it religiously, and like a lot of things she watches religiously, I pick up an episode here and there. The episodes I've seen of Black Mirror, I do enjoy, but it's not something I'm going to make time for.
Yeah, Bandersnatch, I haven't watched it because I, like you, Riley, have watched an episode. And I got through the first episode, and I had a moment where I decided it wasn't fantastical enough for me to digest the dread. It was too, you know, I love me some nihilism and some horror and some existentially harrowing books and movies and video games, but Black Mirror was so accurate to reality that I was like, I don't need to be bummed out by my fiction. The real world already bums me out in these ways.
Well, it's very British in that it starts at a much higher level of self-loathing than American media, right? Like, and it's very true to the British experience, right? There's this sort of undercurrent of hatred of oneself and mm-hmm. one's entire experience, right? And then their media just sort of builds off of that. And so when I consume British media, I have to sort of work up to that level of despair so that I can actually enjoy the story. Because most times when I, you know, when if I'm channel surfing or if I'm, you know, if I come downstairs or whatever and Susan's watching something, I'm just like, oh my God, I hate everything and life is terrible.
Yes.
Oh, it's British. Okay.
It's British. Yeah. It's British. Like, can you imagine if Fallout was made by a British studio rather than an American studio? Like instead of the like, all right, we're going to like smear all of the nihilism with like a candy coating of farcical elements. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's just like, nope.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I remember watching Being Human, which is like such a great, fascinating present like concept about like, you know, this vampire and werewolf and ghost all kind of like living together and trying to exist in like this weird world. And it's like just made for me, but it was so depressing. Like I couldn't handle it after a while. I was just like, wow, like there's no amount of like cool werewolf transformations that will make me want to feel this way.
There are no amount of cool werewolf transformations is probably the title of our first episode.
Nice.
Yeah, that's the pull quote. Yeah, but it's like, for me, it's not necessarily the nihilism and despair, because I enjoy some really dark TV, right? You know, I enjoyed mm-hmm. Breaking Bad and my wife bailed after two episodes, right?
Oh, I couldn't handle it.
That goes to really dark places. It's sort of the mixture of that level of darkness with the with the truly whimsical nature of British comedy. It's like that they can simultaneously be that depressed and also that whimsical is part of their charm, but it's also just jarring as hell, man. It's that is not my experience. I'm not going to consume that media.
Well, I mean, like horror and comedy, they kind of horror and comedy are like strange bedfellows, though. So it kind of makes perfect sense in a sense.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. But you look at you compare that sort of darkness. I feel like the success that Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg and that crew had with their movies like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and The World's End. All three of those movies have that edge that they're built. All three of those movies are built on that self-loathing that you were talking about, Russ.
Yeah.
But at the exact same time, they are all so indebted to these American pop staples. Mm-hmm. That sort of levity ends up softening just the absolute misery that goes through every single one of them. At the end of Shaun of the Dead, Shaun's best friend is still a rotting corpse living in his backyard. But like, it's kind of nice because it's a joke on the ending of Day of the Dead.
Right.
And World's End, you know, it's same thing, yeah.
And I also liked Stone Rose's Second Coming, so I can relate to their relationship.
Right, like it's all fine. Sam, is Bandersnatch a good starting place for me and Riley, who have seen an episode. Like, can we hop back in?
Yeah, I mean, the good thing about Black Mirror is it's an anthology show, so you don't really need any grounding. Like, there are references that, well, but they're like, they're not that important. Like, there are references within the show to, like, at least three other Black Mirror episodes, but, like, you can get through it just fine. So, you know, if you're looking for a jumping in point, go for it. If you want to actually, like, watch the show, I could happily create a curated list of best episodes, because a lot of them are mediocre, in that, like, sometimes I feel like this was so refreshing for me, because I feel like Black Mirror had kind of been circling for a little bit, trying to, like, come up with new ways of telling essentially the same story of, like, how we're gonna destroy them ourselves through technology. So
and here we are.
Yeah.
Can I be editor in chief for just one sec? Yes, please, please do create that curated list.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, that's a great idea.
Get it up, like, tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah. By the way, everybody, that's not a joke. That's how we end all pitch meetings. This is, like, every pitch ends with a ham horn approval or a, like, press your luck for ideas that don't go great.
Toilet flushes.
Flushes, yeah. No, it's not drive time radio, Riley. It's not like, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to 4231, The Burn, here at Escapist Magazine. We've got the creators of Black Mirror on the line.
Oh, and you guys see what came over the transom in the submissions line? Woof, 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 woof. We are not printing that.
Oh, no. Dear God in heaven. So while Sam has been neck deep in Bandersnatch land, I have, over the past week, played through and completed all of Resident Evil 2, the remake, for our review on our site, and you guys can go read that. It's a very good game. But I wanted to talk to you guys about Resident Evil 2, because in playing it, I had a moment of revelation. I grew up. Russ and I actually used this phrase yesterday when we were talking about stories. I went up the mountain and came back. That's right. Descended again with knowledge. Guys, I've given up the juvenile idea of saying that remakes are bad and that everybody's creatively bankrupt if they remake things, and you can't remake things. The original's the only thing that matters, and it's all good. And Resident Evil has brought me to this place in the past. This is the second time over the past 20 years that Capcom has taken one of the foundational entries in this series and said, you know what, we can do it better. And they take this very, very sort of good and still rock solid game that a lot of people consider canonical and rebuild it from the ground up to completely recontextualize it. And Resident Evil 2 does that really good. I get into a lot of this stuff in my review on the site. But something that impresses me so much is that it does sort of everything that you could imagine a remake doing really, really well. It takes all of these fundamental pieces of the original and keeps them in place. This takes the setting, the premise, the plot, and a lot of just, like, the basic elements. Like, here, there are going to be frogmen with exposed brains and knife-sharp tongues that hunt you in these hallways. They're all still there. All of those things are still in place. But they overhaul the presentation of it to give it an entirely different feel. And as much as the original Resident Evil felt very much reflective of the time that it was made, there is no game that is more essentially 1998 than Resident Evil 2. The first thing you have to do is make sure a PC CD-ROM drive is working. That's like the first puzzle you have to do in that game.
Super high tech.
Super high tech. Man, you gotta find MO discs. You gotta find zip drives in that game. But now, like, you know, 20 years later, it can take the setting of 1998 and use that to make something that feels like a period piece. You know, you make a game that you all of a sudden can't think to yourself, why isn't anybody just fucking picking up their phone and calling their friends when any of this is happening? It creates this entirely new sense of fear and an entirely different discomfort when you're playing, as opposed to the original. Something I really liked in the old Resident Evils, I know a lot of people don't like those fixed angles of sort of classic games that use static backgrounds, but I always liked that because the limited perspective warps your sense of things. You're like, I can't see everything. I have to poke around the corners. And it creates this uncomfortable atmosphere that comes from limited vision. And this time, it takes the Resident Evil 4 mold and puts your perspective behind the character's back. You're looking over their shoulder. And so instead of limited perception based on your environment, it's limited perception based on your body. Mm. And everything is super claustrophobic. Everything is super uncomfortable. And it doesn't just throw things away from the old game. It doesn't just trade on a name. It is a true remake. And I love that. I love the opportunity that you find in a remake. And I got to the end of Resident Evil 2, and I thought to myself, nothing in the world, no work of art, should be off limits from remaking whatsoever. Russ Pitts, how do you feel about it?
I feel like, who are you, and where is Anthony? What have you done with him? What are you trying to achieve? Who are you working for? And what do you want from us? I did not enjoy the Resident Evil games, the early Resident Evil games. I didn't have a PlayStation. I was into PCs back then. Mm. And so my friends would, you know, I'd go hang out with my friends and they'd be huddled around the PlayStation and go, you just play Resident Evil. And I'm like, okay, I'll try playing this. No. And I hated it. Like the thing you described about the limited vision and contributing to is like, I hated that technological restriction. It felt artificial to me at the time. I mean, I was playing, you know, much different games, much different kinds of games on the PC. So that kept me from engaging with the Resident Evil series until I think 4 on the GameCube, which was the console games and the PC games started to really sort of come together into what was technologically possible. It was much more of a first person type game that I was familiar with. I'm wondering, is this the game I should play? Should I give Resident Evil another chance through this game?
Oh, no question. No question. Yeah, yeah. And like the other thing that I feel like a lot of people have always sort of bristled at is, you know, the way those games controlled is a very classic style of control that you saw in PC games as well. You know, we call them the tank controls now, mm-hmm. which is all of your, and this is hard to describe, you know, out loud or even in writing, so bear with me, everybody. But the way you move your character is all situational. Up on your controller is always forward for your character rather than you existing in a three-dimensional space. And if you just move the control stick where you want that character to go, if you need to go down and to the left, you'll tilt the stick down and to the left. But in tank controls, which Resident Evil used, you had to press forward and then left and sort of turn them in a circle like you were pivoting on treads. And you used to see this a lot in a lot of early 3D games. You know, the PC
game. It's like the character is a marionette and you're basically moving them from above. Right.
Perfect way to put it. And I always think of Grim Fandango as a game that used that because it, like Resident Evil, was like, here we are. We want to make a point-and-click adventure that uses a 3D space, but how are we actually going to manage that? And that was the best idea at the time. And Resident Evil stuck with it for a while because it really forced you to consider the way that you were going to move around the space. It was to disempower you, which, you know, is a controversial choice. And Resident Evil 2, thankfully, does away with that entirely. Even Resident Evil 4 sort of kept that style of control, like forward was always forward. But a few years ago, when they remastered the 2002 GameCube remake of the original Resident Evil, they completely overhauled the controls and allowed three-dimensional control for the first time. So Resident Evil 2, like, you absolutely can play this as your first one and get what I think is all of the sweet fruit of the series and sort of none of the bitterness. Sam, how do you feel about remakes in general? I'm curious because you have a great passion for things like Russ that I consider sort of classics of our world, like the escapist's purview. You like your Dune, mm-hmm. you like Dungeons and Dragons, you like old Star Trek. And, you know, I feel like for people with our tastes, and especially people of our age, Riley, you're cast out of this age range, but, you know, people from like 35 to 45 are in, I feel like they're more sensitive to this kind of
thing. I'm actually barely under that. I'm only 34, but.
You're only 34. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
But, yeah, only.
You don't look a day older than 29.
Oh, But what I was, yeah. So I think remakes really have to, like anything, I feel like have to justify their existence. And sometimes their road is a little bit harsher because of that, because there's this already perfectly good version of that. And sometimes there isn't, honestly. You know, a lot of times I feel like remakes can improve on the original. I mean, Resident Evil, as you have discussed, and for that matter, I think like Pokemon Let's Go Pikachu is a good example.
Oh yeah, great example.
You know, it's one of those things where it's like it's taking effectively the same game, updating it for some new technology, some new quality of life things that players now expect. And I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know, there are some people that will condemn it for not being original or just being like a nostalgia cash in. But if you you know, I you get into this a bit in your piece about the problem with archival video games, it's hard. Not everyone keeps all their old systems, and if you want to revisit that, it's a lot harder to do that than say revisiting your favorite movie from the 80s. And so I think remakes for video games have a very special place there. You know, remakes and reports for that matter. And, you know, I feel the same way with new versions of books or movies or comic books that are trying to retell different stories in different ways. You know, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to explore that I suggested the new anthology is because fundamentally it's about saying how we tell stories about the same characters over and over and over again and what is gained and lost by doing that. And I think a lot can be gained. You know, characters, the world, technology evolves so much over time that there's a lot to be gained from a fresh perspective on an old story.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny that, you know, we're having this conversation this week, and I wish I had had a chance to read this prior to writing this piece on remakes, but I didn't know that it was coming out this week until I had finished it. And now that I know that it's out there, there is Boom Studios is doing a new series of Buffy the Vampire Slayer comic books with like the approval of the creative staff, you know, Whedon on down. And the premise is that it is just retelling the Buffy the Vampire Slayer story as it was on television. But instead of it being 1997, it's starting in 2019.
Oh, interesting.
And it is like same setup. It's still Buffy Summers. It is still Giles. It is still all of those characters, but they're just starting fresh. And my reaction to that when I found out it was happening was like, fuck that. There's perfectly good continuity. I want to know what it's like for Spike in the year 2482. Like a dum-dum who thinks everything needs to be preserved in amber for all of time. Uh-oh, Russ, I used the metaphor twice.
Yeah, you did.
Just let it go. We're going to act like it didn't happen. It's not in print.
Just going to walk right past it. It's
just
fine.
Walk past it.
Not even going to make a sound effect. Okay.
But like, you know, now I think to myself, there are so many different ways that just changing the year it takes place will fundamentally change the world of Buffy. Social media exists for Xander and Willow and Buffy now. You know, phones do exist. Joyce no longer has to sit there at home and worry about where Buffy is. And all of those stories are still perfectly great stories. They're amazing places to start from and rebuild from. And I'm actually like really excited now that somebody is doing that.
I don't know if this is one of those things where it changes as you get older, but I can tell you my feeling of it has changed as I've gotten older. And now, you know, just to date myself, there was no internet when I grew up. The world was a totally different place. I've always had video games. I'm not that old. But it's been what's been fascinating about life to me has been working in these situations with different teams doing different things, but essentially in the same kind of career, you know, working in entertainment. But the way just the experience of life has changed so much in the time I've been around. It's fascinating to me, you know, even now what we're doing here at Escapist 10 years later, is radically different simply because of the way the world and technology and everything has changed. This, you know, we're able to do cool and unusual things that we weren't able to do 10 years ago. And some things we're not able to do that we were able to do 10 years ago. And I just, for me personally, I find that fascinating. And I think that is why I enjoy remakes in particular. Like I've never really had that sense that remakes are bad. I'm intrigued by the changes, yeah. The changes in a world, the changes in a story simply by moving the setting. Right. Or this is probably why I should give Bandersnatch a chance. You know, the changes in a story just by altering, you know, what you have for breakfast. That's really fascinating and intriguing to me. And I love it. I think it's a really great thing.
Riley, how do you feel about remakes? Is there any like remake that you've ever experienced that is, you know, has taken something that you felt really, really passionate about and then changed? And I don't know, you either embraced that change or bristled at it?
Yes. I would say, I mean, I'm pretty open to remakes in general. I think you can make a story about anything and it can be able to be what it is once it's, depending on time. And it's, as you kind of said with the Buffy comics, it's like, you know, once you kind of explained it with the new technology, but the stories are still great, it makes perfect sense that it could still work. I would say like if there was supposed to be like a remake of like 2001: A Space Odyssey, they should not do that. Because that is perfect to the time. Like I there's some things that I just view as you know, it's already perfect as is and shouldn't be touched, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the issue there, and as Sam said, I kind of talk about this a little. The issue is you don't want the original to be destroyed in the process of remaking it, right?
Yeah.
It's not about replacing something. And I feel like that's where people get a lot of really hung up on the idea of a remake, is that they think like, oh, the thing that I used to treasure is now gone and superseded in some way. And that's just, in the ideal, it's not the case, right? But there are, like, you know, the unfortunate reality is, like, with video games, like, 2001, if somebody remade 2001 tomorrow, and they were just like, Stanley Kubrick was a hack, and their name is Zack Snyder, and it's the Snyderverse.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say Zac Efron. 3001 starring Zac Efron.
Perhaps the worst thing that can be said about remakes, and that I think why there's the generational gap there, is that I think people get very upset about their version of something no longer being the mainstream version of it. You know,
right,
like there are,
right,
there are
right,
people
right.
who primarily know the Transformers through the Michael Bay Transformers, or primarily know Superman through Zack Snyder's movies. And
that's horrifying.
That's horrible.
You just gave me a heart attack.
That sucks.
What are you doing?
That'd be
Stop.
Me.
That's horrible, but it's true. And like, you know, and that's why a bad remake can be so problematic, is that it doesn't, like, those good versions of those things still exist, but if your first exposure to it is such a bad version, you're much less likely to want to go back.
Fair. That's an entirely fair argument. Because those, to me, that the entire Zack Snyderverse of DC was just horrifying. It was not, not only from a, you know, from a subjective creative decision point of view, and in general, I do not like the Zack Snyder milieu, right? 300 was great. He could have stopped there and I would have been happy. I mean, 300 fits for that story. That 300 aesthetic doesn't fit for all the other things he's tried to apply.
Yeah, Sucker Punch is a Hague-worthy crime.
Yeah, it's a horrible film. But like the character of Superman that was fundamentally altered by that film for no good reason whatsoever. And that's troubling.
Yeah, it's because Zack Snyder thinks that Superman is boring and not hardcore enough.
But like it is a creatively valid take. Like, right? Like it's like people
really?
Should be open.
Is it?
I don't think so.
Really? No, it's really not. Like Superman as a little Superman with the touch of evil that Zack Snyder put into his character is not a good character. He's not a good guy. That's a villain.
I'm not saying that he's a good character.
Right? Like an all powerful human being who's that dark is the villain of the story.
But like one of the great Superman comics of the past 20 years is Superman Red Son.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but that fully leans into it, and I just
right.
So I mean, if you read, actually, I wrote about this extensively in my New Mythology Superman and Captain America, and like there are other consequences of that too, which is that people, kids today, don't see Superman as a hero, and so they've turned to Captain America, which is valid. And so, you know, I mean, I can't say, as you say, that, like, you should never tell this story the way that Zack Snyder is doing that. Like, you know, everyone's entitled to their creativity decisions. I think it was a bad move on DC's part. And I am sad for people who don't see Superman the way I did as a kid, because I think they're missing out on something.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
Yeah, conversely, the Marvel MCU Captain America is lighter than he has been traditionally been in the comic books. He could get really dark and gritty in some of the comic books, he's very much more sort of light and frothy in the MCU. And I think fewer people object to that, because it's more of an encapsulation of what makes the character great, not necessarily a rewriting of the character itself.
And I think there are fewer objections because a lot of people, Superman is so big a part of the cultural lexicon, whereas Captain America was always a little bit, you know, less popular. He never had his own cartoon show, for instance.
He did have that badass live action TV show, though, with the clear shield, right? And the motorcycle and that little winged helmet.
And like the doofiest helmet in the entire world. Have you guys ever seen the 1990 Captain America movie where they finished it and they were like, we can't put this in theaters?
I mean, definitely not.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
I've seen footage from it, and it is, I mean, that shield looks like a trash can.
Yeah, it is a trash can. They just spray painted a trash can.
They had they had Christopher Lee in, like, I think, the sequel to that.
Is there a second one of those?
Yeah, it was apparently so good.
It was so good. They needed Hammer Films Dracula. Oh my God.
Well, we need to roll into what you've been up to, Riley. What have you been putting into your brain space?
Shit. No. literally shit. No, I've been basically waiting to play Resident Evil 2. I have never played the older games. Well, I played the first one, but it's mostly just been, like, hype for playing the second one, because I've never actually played that game before.
Why are you excited about it, then? I mean, just because, like, I feel like Resident Evil is one of those series that people who love video games and are passionate about are, like, inevitably feel something. They feel something for Resident Evil, even though if they've never played it before. They're like, I should play Resident Evil, even though they haven't. Like, I'm curious why you're drawn to 2.
I'm drawn to 2 because I love 4 and I really like 7. And I like the direction that they took 7 in compared to 5, which was the only other one that I played, other than 4.
Eesh.
Yeah, I played 5, which was okay at best, just put it lightly, if not controversially.
Because that was Tom Clancy's Resident Evil, right?
Tom Clancy's Resident Evil.
Yeah, but with Resident Evil 2, it just kind of, I don't know, like, from the little bit of trailers that I've seen, like, I don't even know much about it. I think Leon Kennedy is in it, I think?
He is.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
This is the game where Leon comes from.
Okay, yeah, so I didn't even really know that for 100%, and there's like, a woman, and I really literally don't know anything. I mean, there's a T-Virus. I know what Raccoon City is. That
I see. I don't want to tell you anything then. Like, I kind of want you to experience it as blind as possible. Because, yeah, like, the premise of Resident Evil 2, what it sets up for you right at the top, is that, you know, not even a full year after the first game, when there was just, like, a bunch of zombies in a mansion because a bunch of people who made a bad virus lost control of it. Yeah, like, that didn't really work out. They didn't really, like, and we cleaned all that mess up. That just sort of spills down into the town.
Yeah.
And things get a little crazy. Especially because 4 and 7 are your reference points for this rather than the original Resident Evil 2. You're gonna feel right at home, because presentationally, this remake is the sort of perfect marriage of those two games. It has the same perspective as Resident Evil 4, but it has the same sort of emphasis on disempowerment and resource management that you saw come back in Resident Evil 7, and it has the same sort of flow, through the environment, where you're stuck pretty much inside, and you go through a lot of different interior spaces, but you can move seamlessly between them. Something I loved about Seven was the fact that the doors, like, you have to, like, push through a door. That comes back here. Did you play Seven in VR?
I did not. I don't have a VR device, but I've heard it's amazing, like, in VR. Well, that's what some people said. maybe not you, but
well, no. I wish I could play Seven in VR. I've tried many times, but it gives me a bad case of the heaves.
Yeah, I think I would just curl up in a corner and cry.
Yeah,
after like 5 minutes, I can barely play it. Not in VR.
Are you not a horror game?
Not
person?
A fan.
Not Aww. A fan. It's so weird. You love like Eldritch, Lovecraftian stuff when it comes to video games, but like that's I don't really consider those horror.
Yeah. So that's the thing, is it's the difference between psychological and physical. So like I'm cool with my character going slowly insane or seeing things that man was not meant to see, or like fighting. Like if I'm like, I don't know. I do not like playing games where I run out of bullets, where I can't see, and where I'm getting eaten by things.
I'm still like angry at H.P. Lovecraft. Well, I'm angry at H.P. Lovecraft for a lot of things, but
and so is H.P. Lovecraft.
It's always every time it's H.P. Yeah. Lovecraft in Call of Cthulhu. I just like the writer's cheat of being like it was all made of non-Euclidean geometry. Like you can't say that and not describe the space. You dingus. Describe your setting, you lazy ass.
It's indescribable.
He's
describing the indescribable. That's why they went insane.
Lazy.
If you were to read it,
you would also go insane.
You would, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Just the lazy.
He's trying to protect you.
Anthony, it was all a dream.
Lazy, okay. Just shiftless Lovecraft.
Right. How do we get out of this? Is that how we get out of this?
Right, yeah, that's our moment. That's our moment. Yeah. All right, everybody who's listening, I want to encourage you to, after this, get into the comment section on the post if you're listening to this on Escapist Magazine, and let us know what you think. Let us know about the format. Let us know what you want to hear in the podcast. If you're not and you're seeing this a few days later as the first episode populates on iTunes and Spotify, get at us on Twitter. That's @EscapistMag on Twitter, and let us know what you think of the podcast. Let us know what you want to hear us talk about. We're also going to be having on everybody that contributes to the podcast as we continue to go. We're going to have Bob Chipman. We're going to have Yahtzee Croshaw. We're going to have Noah Berlatsky, whose new column, Art Must Be Ruined, is going on. Hopefully we'll have Adam Adler, Sean Sands, a lot of our other contributors. But let us know what you want. We want this to be your show as much as it is ours. Russ, where can the people find you, and what do you want to point them to on the site?
You know what? The people can find me at Russ Pitts on Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter to a fault. You know, I want to point them to Escapist Magazine Volume 2, and I want to end this with just a little bit about how grateful we are to get this opportunity to bring Escapist Magazine back. There was so much that Escapist meant to so many people over the years. We have a 14-year heritage that we are trying to live up to. And bringing this thing back was not a small thing, and it wasn't a selfish thing. It's, you know, we've had to be so careful to keep in mind what so many people have engaged with this property on and through, what they expect from it, how we're going to bring it back in this there 21st century, and it'd be meaningful in the same way, again, maybe to the same people, maybe not to the same people. I think we have a really solid opportunity here to reconnect with a lot of people that were a part of our community for so long, and bring some of that escapist love and joy back to them, which was no small thing for a lot of folks, myself included. So I'm just grateful to everyone listening to this podcast. I'm grateful to everyone who's been viewing the site, consuming all of our content. Thank you so much. This is why we do it. And let us know what you want to see more of on the site as well.
Riley, where can people find you?
They can find me in the snow and on Twitter. but it's cold out here, by the way. But it's they can find me on Twitter at Biological Riley. That's my Twitter handle. Or if they look up Scribe, they can probably find.
And they look up Scribe.
If they look up Escapist Scribe.
Yeah, there'd be a picture of Riley there. Riley.
And Sam Nelson, where can the people find you besides getting into the division next week?
I'm also on Twitter at SamanthaNelson1. And yeah, you'll see me publish the Escapist Unplugged column every Monday where I talk about board gaming.
Smash that like button.
Smash that like button. And we'll see you hitchhiking across America as the entire air system shuts down.
Yeah, I'm just really hoping I just get to San Francisco smoothly and everything works out okay. Otherwise, you are going to get salty, salty messages from me.
We'll have salty Sam. There's a good train that goes right from San Francisco to Chicago. We were actually talking, one of my first, our good friend Charlie Hall, when I hired him at Polygon, one of his first assignments was to get on a plane and go to the Ukraine barely a month before a rebellion kicked off in that country. And everyone he interviewed went into hiding. So maybe with any luck, you'll get out of San Francisco just before the apocalypse.
Cool. Yeah. I'll do my best. Because honestly, actually, I'd rather weather the apocalypse in San Francisco than Chicago. It's really cold here right now.
It's true. That's true. So I think San Francisco is going to be the center of the societal breakdown, really, because you have all the components. You have the, you know, the income inequality, mm-hmm. class disparity.
The technology being built. So if we have like the tech apocalypse, it'll come from there.
Tim Rogers running through the street.
Yeah, it's a small space. Yeah. You have tsunamis.
Obnoxious hills, too.
It's a transportation hub. So if we've got the viral apocalypse, there's good ways for it to come and go.
That's right. So just don't stop recording. That's the thing.
Sounds good.
Just get it all down, man. Just get it all down. And then if you survive, you can write a book.
Russ, you want to ham horn us out?
I'm going to ham horn us out. Everybody, this is Escapist Magazine podcast. Damn, I'm already messing it up. It's too convoluted. It needs to be something like...
No, the website is Escapist Magazine, Volume 2.
And then the podcast is Volume 2. Volume 2. This is the Escapist Podcast, Volume 2.
If anybody can hear the Perfect Strangers theme song starting to play in their head, that's appropriate.
Cousin Larry taking us out with a sad trombone. Join us next week. We're going to do a lot of this. Thank y'all so much for listening.
Bye, everyone.